I was asked by Nash and the other organizers to lead a discussion. Looks like people may have already tired out for the day, but I'd like to make a few comments about black holes in general, about ideas of resolving the various paradoxes, and then hopefully connect. The whole idea is to connect to observations in the EHT and in LIGO. So here's the standard textbook picture. Maybe you don't like the labels, but basically the analytically continued Schwarzschild solution, where most of what I'm going to say to keep matters simple is going to be the non-rotating Schwarzschild case, although I'll show you one slide next on the rotating case. Well, the basic idea is that you take the exterior solution which Schwarzschild first found and then introduce new coordinates which analytically continue through the horizon and give you this picture which Gerhard also showed a version of this morning. Now, in addition to the singularity, which I think is only one issue, which you may or may not be concerned about, you have to also think about the rotating case, and it was alluded to also, I think, in some of the talks this morning. Then these analytic continuation methods of mathematics is very beautiful. One can still do it, but you get an extremely interesting, involved, and peculiar picture of this maximal analytic extension. You get more singularities, more asymptotically flat universes or parallel, whatever you want to call them, but even more strikingly, you get closed time-like curves, that is, paths in geodesics inside the interior in which you can return to yourself or your great-grandparents. So it's very strange, to say the least, and most people would say it's unphysical. In fact, I asked Roy Kerr what he thought about all this, and he answered very nicely. He said that, well, sometimes in order to solve equations, you have to make assumptions of symmetry. It doesn't mean that's exactly the way things are. So the question is, can we learn anything about what's going on inside horizons or at the horizon, would-be horizon, from exterior measurements, which is where we are. So I first want to remind you also that the ideas that black holes form go back really to the 60s when there was a phase change. The early people like Eddington and Einstein didn't actually have a very strong, or even Dirac did not have a positive idea about what we now call black holes. But things changed in the 60s due to a series of theorems proven by Penrose and Hawking and Penrose, namely that if you impose some conditions on the stress tensor of matter, then and a trapped surface first forms, then you must form a black hole singularity. And so these are really the basis of Einstein. You know, people say general relativity is tested or not, but what's being tested, of course, is the Einstein equation coupled to some matter. And what you assume for the matter determines what the metric does. So you can never completely divorce the Einstein theory from statements about the matter fields. And this is one very pertinent example. And the other thing to bear in mind is that the conditions seem very reasonable for ordinary matter. But in fact, we already know examples where they're violated. For example, I'll talk a little bit about nuclear physics, the hadronic bag, which could actually play a role inside of neutron stars at high densities. But for cosmologists, certainly the dark energy of P equals minus rho violates this condition in particular. And that can lead to very different physics. I mean, ultimately, of course, what's going on is that if you have positivity conditions on the matter stress tensor, then gravity is attractive, and so geodesics, once inside, have to converge, and you have a singularity and you're stuck. Whereas if those conditions are not correct, then or change in the interior, then you can get very different things. And in fact, the accelerating expansion of the universe is an example of the effective repulsion that comes about when you have when you violate this condition. Okay. So a few words, since we've alluded to this, and I think it generates a lot of work and interest over really four decades now, of what's going on with black holes, thermodynamics, and entropy. So just remind you of very basic things. Usually, if you have a classical solution to any equations, take Maxwell's equations, Coulomb potential, you would find it very strange to call that solution to have any entropy. It's a fixed classical configuration. But of course, with black hole, we think it might be different because ordinary matter can fall into a black hole under the standard picture, and we have these no-hair theorems, which tell us that only the mass, angular momentum, and if possible, the total charge remains. So this goes back to discussions that Wheeler had with people, his students in particular, in Princeton, and Bekenstein came up with the idea that maybe area was a kind of measure of entropy, because there were theorems proving, again, with positivity of energy conditions, that the area always increased, which is very reasonable, since if you put more matter in, the thing should get bigger. But in order to make an entropy out of it, you know, we're very clever, we often put natural units, but you should bear in mind that what's going on is you're dividing a classical area by a quantum length scale, which is the Planck scale squared, and because there is no other length scale you can think of to divide by, and that produces, of course, an enormous entropy since the area is extremely large in Planck units. And that was met with skepticism. It would solve the problem of loss of entropy because this is so huge, basically, that anything you drop in, that's going to increase by such an amount that it's going to overwhelm whatever you may have lost from the matter falling in. But then Hawking came very shortly after and said, oh, but radiation actually comes out thermally with a certain temperature, inversely proportional to the mass, we'll put all the units in, and therefore it seems that this classical relation looks like the first law of thermodynamics, and that also fixes this proportionality factor in Bekenstein's argument to 1/4 and gives us the famous quarter area law. However, you should bear in mind again, one reason I'm putting all the constants in is that this is actually a classical relation. So it was proven for classical solutions of Einstein's equations before there was any talk of entropy or thermodynamics. And this is just a statement that that if I increase the area of any sequence of black holes of given mass, angular momentum, and charge, that there's a proportionality constant, which is basically the surface gravity, kappa, that determines how much the energy or the mass increases. So in effect, one has multiplied and divided by h-bar and taken a classical relation and reinterpreted quantum mechanically. Whereas I'm going to argue, and I'll give you an explicit example, that if you had just looked at this relation, or maybe someone like Lord Rayleigh had looked at this relation in the 19th century, would have said, well, gee, the energy increases as they increase the area. Isn't that telling me something about the surface? That's actually how, if you go look at standard fluid dynamics, that's how you discuss the surface tension of a bubble, is by looking at how the energy increases with the area under small changes. That is the surface tension. So, but in the picture that we've been handed by Hawking and his heirs, we are essentially multiplying, dividing by h bar, taking that classical relation and calling it quantum, and then follow all these issues. The area is non-extensive, it's not the volume, so usually entropy goes like the volume, but now it's the area. And it's also very large numerically. You should put in the numbers for your entertainment. And for a solar mass object, it's about a factor of 10 to the 19 larger in the entropy than any progenitor you could imagine. Remember Boltzmann's formula that the entropy is the log of the number of microstates. So that means you had to have e to the 10 to the 19 more microstates than you thought when you formed the whole. And you know, there are other features, the more you think about this. In the classical limit, go back to the Hawking formula, h bar going to zero, that's like very large object. The temperature goes to zero, but the entropy goes to infinity. So talk to a cold temperature physicist and see what they think of that. Usually that's not the way things work. Also, energy proportional to the inverse temperature, the temperature is inversely proportional to mass, so the energy is inversely proportional to the temperature. So therefore the heat capacity, dE dt, is negative. And in fact, it's numerically very large and negative. So this usually tells you that you can't do equilibrium thermodynamics because the heat capacity is proportional to the square of the fluctuations, the average value, in any thermodynamics textbook. In fact, Einstein is associated with that fluctuation dissipation ideas. So that's a very strange concept, to have negative heat capacity and very large and negative. I guess some speakers like Jim already were talking about doing these calculations. Usually in fixed classical backgrounds, certainly Hawking's calculation, the metric is given once and for all. It's fixed as a classical potential, essentially, in which you examine scattering states. So one doesn't know or think hard at that level about what the effect of this radiation could be on the background itself. And finally, we have the words that people mouth at all these conferences about the information paradox. So if you have this huge entropy, somehow it appears that information has disappeared. And Hawking himself actually oscillated on this issue. At one point, he was talking about pure states to mixed states, and then changed his mind. And I'm not sure exactly what the final conclusion was in his mind, but I guess he thought that string theory or some version of ADS-CFT would solve it. But as far as I know, there is no complete and satisfactory solution to this, in, at least with standard assumptions. So the problems are there. So I want to try to advocate going back to first principles and trying to see what the root of the problem is. So first of all, again, some remarks of simple kinematics. If you look at just the Tolman redshift relation, of course, you're coming out of a deep potential well. So a frequency of a photon, for example, at infinity is redshifted as it comes out, which means that if it started close to the horizon, it had to be very, very, very much more much higher frequency than when it, you observe it at infinity. Now, classically, that isn't particularly a problem because we can talk about waves at any frequency or any wavelength. But remember, when h bar enters the game, then frequencies should be converted to energies. So the energy of this photon, if it started out very close to the horizon, was very, very large. What this immediately tells you is that you have to be careful. This should raise a red flag. It means that as h bar goes to zero is not necessarily commuting with the limit of going to the event horizon. And we're not really familiar in everyday physics with this kind of limit. We're either operating in a very weak gravity regime or in a regime where quantum effects are small and under control. And here you can have a competition between the two. I won't have time to talk about it, I won't try in this discussion, but there are a lot of indications that when you try to do quantum field theory, the quantum vacuum, this is only a statement of a single photon, but the quantum vacuum is, of course, a collection of many such modes. And if you try to keep track of that, basically the floor of your quantum vacuum state is changing dramatically as you go to the horizon in comparison to the observer at infinity. So the quantum vacuum is going to play a role in these discussions. And there are many calculations. I'll try to argue generically, but I won't do it here. But I have argued on very generic grounds, just by basically keeping track of powers of omega and h bar. And I can give you much stronger arguments and much more specific calculations in the papers. But basically, you should generically expect stresses that are growing as you approach the horizon, like this factor of the local frequency, with an h-bar in front. So the usual statement is, well, quantum effects must be small because the black hole is very big. So therefore, you know, the 10 to the 9, 6 times 10 to the 9 solar masses that Avery is talking about in M87, the mass is enormous, and so h-bar shouldn't play a role. Well, that's true that the coefficient is m to the minus 4, so the overall scale is very small. But if you have this factor of blowing up near the horizon, it doesn't matter how big the mass is, it can eventually overcome it by getting close enough to R equals 2gm. And that's the main point I'm going to try to make. If you actually estimate when is this factor comparable to the classical curvatures, the classical Riemann tensor in normal coordinates, well, a simple calculation will tell you that R has to be within a Planck mass, a Planck length of the horizon radius. And that means, because of the metric, that the physical length scale is going like the geometric mean of the horizon radius in the Planck scale. So this is different from what Bob will come back and talk about his talk, if you want. But I would say from semi-classical analysis, you have a characteristic scale at which you must expect, or at least should worry about, quantum effects playing a role on the classical geometry. And so this is a very small scale for astrophysics, and therefore can look very much like a black hole in all its faces as far as the astrophysical observables. But you should also know, from a theoretical point of view, this is very much larger than the Planck scale, so we ought to be able to discuss it in some kind of effective field theory language.
Yeah. All these statements are coordinate dependent. Why should we test
this? This is not coordinate dependent. You can look at the upper and lower components and go to a normal frame. In a normal frame,
No, it's not.
Excuse me. The tensor transforms as a tensor.
Right.
But if you take the diagonal matrix elements, or equivalently, think of it as a matrix and look at its eigenvalues, those eigenvalues are coordinate independent.
No, but the choice of a state, I think...
The choice of state is a different statement.
I think that's the key.
No, but that's a different statement. Okay, so there's no problem of coordinate. I've purposely written this as one up and one down. If you write them both down, then you bring in the metric, and then the metric will have issues of coordinate dependent. But the eigenvalues of the stress tensor matrix is basically going to you can diagonalize it, and those diagonal matrix elements are coordinate independent.
The issue is that if I find an infalling observer, I don't see this.
No, it's nothing to do with infalling observers. This is a statement of, he is right, it's a statement of the quantum state here, but not a statement about observers. So this is one. When you started your talk, you said there are many confusions. Indeed, there are many confusions. But I'll have to get past this, or we'll never get to the interesting things we can discuss. But this is truly a state-dependent question. So yes, you should ask about what these brackets mean. But it is not an observer-dependent statement, and it's not a coordinate-dependent statement. It's a question of what kind of source can there be to the Einstein equations, and therefore what the geometry is going to do. Not a question of what somebody sees. Okay.
I think the question: do you agree that there exist the states in a standard quantum field theory where this is?
Yeah. I mean that would take me a long way away.
But you agree,
I claim this is the generic situation.
There are states
which I also claim are a set of measure zero. But there are some states for which this coefficient is zero.
But if you like bottom line. Why take R minus 2 here and to be just L plus?
Because
that's very strange, because you should have the metric tensor there.
This is in Schwarzschild coordinates. So this is the statement that when this happens, then this coefficient becomes beats this one and becomes of order. The whole thing becomes of order 1 over m squared, which is the classical the scale of the classical Riemann tensor. So the, you know, the, oh, come on, what's the problem? If I look at this thing, this thing is going like m over r cubed, right? So if I go to r of 2gm, the typical scale of this is 1 over m squared, near to the horizon. So the question is, when can this effect, assuming the coefficient is not zero, when can this effect become comparable to the give you a comparably large order one back reaction on the metric? Okay, and this factor does depend on the metric. This is a coordinate dependent state, but this is the physical length scale because, of course, you have a physical scale, which is dr over 1 minus 2m over r, right? So that's the physical length scale height above the horizon at which this effect can become of order 1. That's the statement. I told you how. Just put it in. Put this.
You have to get the dimensionless number. What is the, which dimensionless number?
This is a length scale.
Yes, but I would like a dimensionless number.
The dimensionless number is the dimensionless number is L Planck over 2gm. That's a dimensionless number. So this dimensionless number has to overcome this scale to make this of order 1 over m squared. Think of this as L Planck squared over m squared. I don't understand the problem, but I can straighten anything out later. Please, let's go on. Okay, now another thing I want to say is you typically hear, I think it came up even in Bob's talk, that, oh, well, the curvatures are small. Indeed, they are. The curvatures look like this. So if the mass is big, the curvature is small. Okay, but I want to remind you that if we're trying to talk about quantum effects, it's very dangerous to talk about local curvatures only. Certainly those are important, but not the whole story. And this is the issue of whether you can just coordinately transform away this singularity. Of course, if you have a singular metric and you transform it away, then you've made a singular coordinate transformation. And singular coordinate transformations need not be harmless. A simple example, which none of the field theorists should argue with, is in QED, in the U1 gauge theory, we have a gauge invariant quantity, which is the gauge potential integrated over a circle. That's non-local, okay? And if it were just a pure phase, if it were just the angle that we're integrating, then we would say this is a pure gauge, right? It's pure gauge, so there's no force. There's no potential, I mean, there's no field there at all, and therefore I can gauge it away. Of course, that would be wrong because theta is ill-defined at the origin, and in that way, you've missed the possibility of having non-zero circulations or vortices in superfluids. Another example is the Aronoff-Bohm effect, where it's the scattering of electrons around a solenoid in which the magnetic field is completely confined to the solenoid. Nevertheless, the field inside the solenoid somehow affects what's going on outside because of this non-trivial gauge potential, which means is not surprising, really, from the point of view of wave mechanics, because quantum mechanics is not about point particles, it's about waves. Waves have boundary conditions. Boundary conditions care about whether or not you have these non-trivial phase factors or singularities in your potential. So I think it's just a mistake to say that if I have small fields, then I have no quantum effects. Those quantum effects are non-local, and they're not acausal, they're non-local, and they don't require large curvatures. That's another point. Now, before going too far into complicated things on quantum theory, I want to make a remark, because this was work we did a few years ago, and I think it's actually interesting for several reasons. So I do want to talk about it. And that is that even though these effects that I'm talking about are quantum, one can actually see that classical Einstein equations already have a place for something to happen on the horizon. And it's actually inherent in the first or second solution that Schwarzschild wrote down. So I'm going to briefly talk about that, then I'll get to the discussion session. So the simple example, let's again say as simple as possible, with static and spherical symmetry, if there is a theorem proved by Buchdahl back in the late 50s, which is discussed in many textbooks, not always giving credit to Buchdahl, that if you have a fluid with isotropic pressure as a function of only of R, and the metric is F, those two functions I call F and H, and if the energy density is a monotonically decreasing function of R in the interior, Buchdahl proved that the radius of this object has to be bigger than 9/8 the Schwarzschild radius, or else one of the assumptions or a singularity has to, one of the assumptions is wrong or a singularity has to form. So this is usually taken as an indication that a black hole has to form. However, what we did was re-examine this business a little bit more carefully. And so we're really going back to the beginning now. And this is classical general relativity. No fancy quantum effects. Because the Buchdahl bound depends on this inequality, which is reasonable enough, that's usually what you need for a stability of a fluid ball, it's true for stars, for example, then the interesting case is to saturate the inequality where the interior is has a constant energy density. And that's exactly what Schwarzschild did in his second paper before he died by that tragic death that you talked about. The history is really interesting. The first paper he wrote to, he sent to Einstein. Einstein was very happy because he didn't think that anyone would ever solve those equations. And here was someone who solved them instantaneously, essentially. But the next thing he did was try to look at the interior, not just the exterior, which we call the Schwarzschild black hole, but the interior, try to match it. He wanted to make a star. And
that led to his death, I guess.
I hope no. I don't think that led to his death. But anyway, Einstein was not happy with that paper. Well, basically, I think for not the right reason. Namely, well, he said, well, it can't have constant density because that would produce an infinite speed of sound, and that violates relativity. But of course, it was just a model, and it's actually a very interesting model to go back to because of these later developments. So here's the solution. It's basically trivial. You can find it in many textbooks. You solve for the pressure, and the pressure is just this function of R, where the little r is the variable, the radial variable, and h squared is, to use a notation familiar from cosmology, is basically the average density inside, 8 pi g over 3 times the average density. Now, the thing you see is how the Buchdahl bound works, because this has a denominator, and the denominator goes to 0 at a certain radius, namely this one, and that 0 exists on the real axis if and only if the radius of the star is less than 9/8 the Schwarzschild radius. If it's greater than 9/8, no problem. The solution is regular. But if it becomes less than 9/8, then the 0 appears at the origin. And so that's usually where people stop for about 100 years. So what we did was just look at this a little harder and see, well, what happens if I keep going? First of all, what happens to this pressure singularity? And can I understand it? And it turns out that if you just, I won't go through the details for time, you can see it in our papers, but if you go all the way to the limit in which the radius of the object becomes 9/8, then you see from this simple formula that the radius at which this pressure singularity exists actually goes out to the Schwarzschild radius itself, so all three of these quantities become the same. So the radius of the object is the Schwarzschild radius, is the radius at where there's some discontinuity in the derivatives of the metric, but it turns out, and you can just see here, that limit corresponds to this quantity being 1. If that's 1, this just drops out. Sorry, this and this drop out, and then the ratio is just minus 1. So the pressure is equal to minus the density, which is a constant. In other words, it's a de Sitter interior. So just going through this exercise gives you an actual model which you can look at. And it's all classical GR. Again, again emphasize. And the important quantity to look at, again, I'll skip for lack of time, is the Komar mass energy formula, which tells you how the surface gravity of the object behaves as a function of r, and the integral of that quantity is, in fact, the total mass at infinity. And the important thing for us is that this quantity is finitely integrable across the discontinuity because f goes to zero, this quantity f goes to zero at exactly the same place. F is just the square of this. So f goes to zero at exactly the same place where the pressure would be going to infinity. And in fact, this quantity is finite. And so in this limit, you actually get a p equals minus rho interior. Everything is nicely behaved. There's no singularity, of course, in the interior. And all the interesting stuff is now pushed to the surface, which the metric is the metric is regular there, except this first derivative is discontinuous. And that discontinuity is the discontinuity in the surface gravities, which you can then interpret by standard methods to be a surface tension. In other words, it's not the kappa itself as it appears in the black hole formula, but the difference of kappa between inside and out, which is actually a surface tension. Because if you now look at the conservation of energy, everything works fine. The energy first law equation is fine. There's a volume energy coming from this de Sitter interior, and there's a surface term coming from the discontinuity of the surface gravities, which is the surface tension. You can literally interpret it as such in this classical solution. So what you end up with by reconsidering this century-old problem of Schwarzschild is a zero entropy, zero temperature interior, which we call a condensate for reasons I'll explain if I have time. And it's not a firewall because this is low temperature. We have no thermal radiation here, no hot plasma, nothing. It's just p equals minus rho. If you think about what that means from thermodynamic considerations, that must mean zero temperature and or zero entropy, and there's no conserved baryon number here in this problem. So the discontinuity implies a non-analytic behavior. There's no trapped surface. It's static. The time is time all the way through. And it completely changes the interpretation of the first law back to its classical interpretation, just corrected by the difference of the surface tension, the difference of the surface gravities between inside and out. And then you can really interpret this as surface tension, not temperature, and the area is the area, not entropy. Okay? So obviously, there's problems are solved, right? If such an object takes the place of a black hole, and historically, it's kind of interesting. We use modern techniques, Komar, all this stuff came in the 60s, and boundary conditions, all that stuff came much later, but actually, inherent in Schwarzschild's second paper was a possible resolution to all of the black hole issues. And if history had gone a different way, you could have been talking about these objects instead of black holes from the beginning. Now, all of this is classical. This is a delta function at that cusp. Of course, in order to get that in the real world, you're going to have to discuss some additional physics, and that's where this quantum effects come on. But I want to open up a discussion here before too long. So just a few more remarks. Because the surface tension comes out to be positive, a priori didn't know it was going to be that way, it is the same, essentially, as an ordinary bubble. It's a relativistic object. This is happening right at the would-be null surface. But since the surface tension is positive, it means that small oscillations, small changes in the area, are going to increase the entropy, and you would expect them to have a restoring force. So just for the same reason a soap bubble is roughly stable, because the surface tension pulls it back. So this is not a dynamical analysis, just a static solution, and much more needs to be done. But you would expect such an object to have normal modes on its surface, which are discrete, and which could be very interesting, There's a lot of work to do here to make this into a model to predict, to, you know, compare to observations. But just qualitatively, you immediately see that you expect a quite different signature than you get from quasi-normal modes in black holes. And on this kind of scale, because the scale is set by the only thing in town, which is the size, the light travel time of the object, which, you know, is an interesting, possibly LIGO range, but also not an optical range that might be relevant for things like BHT. You can also look at geometric optics propagating rays for this thing. And of course, that's an approximation. Real photons have wavelength and they may interact with the surface. But if I just take the pure geometry and assume everything's transparent, in the optical limit, in the geometric optical limit, you get a defocusing of rays, which is just the statement that P equals minus rho violates the energy conditions usually used, and therefore rays are defocused rather than focused. So everything out here looks the same. You still have the gravitational lensing and the modeling that Avery and others do for M87, but inside, you could have a very different, you know, if I had a light source right behind here, and this was really correct to use the geometric optics limit, which is not obvious, then you would have a different imaging characteristic. And by the way, since this red, the surface is so deeply redshifted, you do not expect it to be bright. You expect that you have to climb back out of this potential well, and, you know, as just kinematics tells you, most rays are going to come back and not actually get out. So you really expect a dark object, which is going to look and taste and feel like a black hole in many, many respects, until you can probe the near horizon physics very, very precisely. So to do a better job, of course, we're going to have to do a physics-based model of this surface. And I'm not going to talk about it here. We're working on that. But I don't expect to get any substantial optical or infrared emission. Sure. I got a couple more slides. I'm going to stop here soon. So we've already talked about interior echoes. I believe this is different than Bob Holden's scenario and maybe could be distinguished from such, because the centrifugal barrier is there, and therefore there will be this possibility of trapping waves in between the light ring potential and the centrifugal barrier for all angular momentum states different than zero. People have discussed this. In fact, picture is borrowed from a paper by Paolo Pani showing that these kind of objects could produce echoes. So, we have to work towards, you know, actually having a realistic, this thing is not rotating. What has been done, I guess, it's mentioned on this slide, it has been generalized to slow rotation by a student of my colleague, Pavel Mazur. It's published there. But to go beyond very slow rotation, I guess it's up to second order in the rotation is difficult. So he pushed it only to that order. So we don't have a fully rotating solution yet, which we definitely would want and need to compare with actual astrophysics. So I'm just going to summarize this. I don't think I have to read it. I think I've made the points. The pressure is an integrable, so this looks like a sensible boundary layer. And basically, general relativity, you know, is much like Navier-Stokes equations. It has to be correct because it builds in the right conservation laws and symmetries. And it tells you when it breaks down. When you have a shock wave, the fluid approximation breaks. And this, and so one way of thinking about what's going on this surface is that it's a shock wave sitting there right on the null surface, which is propagating at the speed of light, but it's stationary as far as an external observer is concerned. In order for this to make sense, of course, vacuum energy has to change from inside to out, because we have de Sitter inside and Schwarzschild out. And from that, we have to now turn to more than classical relativity. We need a model which builds in this possibility. I mentioned, it's not always emphasized, But in nuclear physics and QCD, this already exists. Namely, the Bragg constant has this equation of state. Usually, nuclear physicists aren't interested in the gravitational effects, but there are reasons to think that gluons can form a condensate, even in ordinary nuclei, in our ordinary matter. But this condensate could be density dependent. So in a neutron star, I actually have the prototype of generating this vacuum energy inside. I've already made this point. I think we're going to have a discussion, I'm sure. But I think this is quite consistent with the observations that you guys have brilliantly made. But there's more work to do, and we definitely have to live with whatever constraints you give us. But the main points for the theoretical side is that surface tension should be interpreted, I would say, as surface tension, not temperature, at least in this class of ideas. Unitarity is fine. There's no information paradox. There's no large number of microstates, in fact. There's a vacuum state. It's a condensate. Both echoes and discrete surface modes are qualitative predictions, and we need to work out more quantitative predictions and modeling. And the full solution is something I will not try to talk about here because I want to start discussion, but I think the place to start the discussion might be what you have assumed to get this picture and whether or not that may or may not apply to this object. But discussion, stop.
So I think maybe it's just, Avery, you were going to say something.
Go ahead, yeah.
I was going to ask about this defocusing. I just want to better understand how this would hide. And so the idea, certainly if I take my laser pointer and I'm sitting very far away from the black hole and I face it very accurately, the defocusing is going to spread my photons out from the very narrow beam that's coming in. And then of those photons that are not spread out, most of them just kind of live in this photon atmosphere around the object because they are not in the escape cone.
Right.
And some small fraction of them make it out on the other side of the escape cone.
After possibly interacting with the surface many times or whatever.
Okay, yeah. So let's pretend it's not going to interact with the surface.
Okay.
Whereas in practice, what we really have is a nearly 4 pi illumination. Right, it's being lit up from all directions. And so what I really am living with is the disparity between 4 pi and the escape cone down near the surface. But don't I generate then this?
I mean, most of the photons don't escape. That's still true. In fact, it's controlled by this very small number.
But I'm going to have this atmosphere that's distributed and I have to think for a minute exactly how, distributed in radius between ostensible Schwarzschild radius and the photon orbit.
If I
drop electrons and other particles into that region, I wonder how much do I have to build up that atmosphere before enough photons are escaping.
Of course, a great question. The picture I have in mind, because it comes from looking at these simple-minded static solutions, is that because we have a sequence of static solutions, that basically I can move from one to the next. So I'm imagining, and this is a calculation that one should be able to do in standard model, is that if I sprinkle radiation, or electrons, whatever, standard matter particles onto the surface slowly enough, they will be absorbed. They will be converted into this interior or live exactly on the surface. They will not be re-emitted. Now, there must be some critical rate beyond which, if it's too fast, the system can't respond that fast. And therefore, there's going to be some atmosphere or re-radiation out. And that's the critical number to get a handle on. You know, Niesch has also been looking at models where there's a finite reflectivity. And so that may be interesting to parameterize things that way and just see what sort of observational handle one has on those parameters. And that's one way to go. I guess I'm trying to be a little bit more first principles based, but in the meantime, yes, I think you would agree, right? If enough is absorbed, then I'm not gonna see anything.
So you asked what goes into that, what assumptions go into the
right?
So we assume that the system can reach a steady state, which means that the thunder sphere down at the bottom is in steady
state. So you're imagining like a floor, you know, like the surface of the Earth, where there's an atmosphere that it's holding up an atmosphere.
Yeah, it could be that, or it could be an optically thick ball at the center of a boson star or something like that. I mean, yeah.
But is the steady state that everything that goes in comes out? Is that what the inverse steady
state? A steady state means that there's the kinetic luminosity that's coming in is being re-emitted thermally.
So there's basically nothing that's absorbed then, like nothing is left behind.
That's right.
Yeah. So the.
But if that was true, then black holes would never grow, right? Because if everything that goes into a black hole comes out, then
so,
they would.
So,
no. But he's assuming
black
a surface.
Is a way to get around the argument.
Yeah.
So.
But
precisely because of that, right? They're not steady state. But another way is just make the time scale for reaching steady state very, very long. And I think at some level, that's what the small escape fraction is trying to do. It's trying to make it very hard to come into thermal equilibrium at a high enough temperature to be bright enough locally so that at infinity you reach that state.
Right.
And certainly converting infalling material into your surface, whatever that is, would also get around that.
That's right.
But of course, until there's a concrete model for that, it's a
fair enough. But one can in the meantime parameterize it and say if some fraction is falling in at some, and that might be a wavelength dependent function, then you know, what do I have to assume in order not to produce this signal? And my feeling is, I haven't done a careful enough calculation, but just back of the envelope, my feeling is that it wouldn't take very much. I could just absorb, and I would expect to absorb quite a bit of what infalls in a normal environment, that you're just not gonna see that. But that, I agree, that's a constraint.
George Chaplin and Bob
Laughlin. Laughlin, Bob Laughlin.
Laughlin. Yeah. They had some pictures, not this exactly, but in which there was a very large heat capacity.
Yeah.
So it takes a long time. In fact, it takes so long that something like Galactic Center or M87 today, it's practically forever. It would never come into equilibrium, except for the fact that, of course, that's a large heat capacity, is a double-edged sword. You know, not only is it hard to come into equilibrium today, but it's hard to not be in equilibrium if you thought that these objects formed substantially by accretion in the past. So it should still be hot from that. And so I'm wondering if there's like some damned if you do and damned if you don't argument here.
I'm not relying on a large heat capacity as that argument. I'm relying on a large absorption coefficient.
Yeah, right.
Which is a different argument. But yeah, there are a number of uncertainties which, until we can develop the theory far enough, or make some model, we can't. But I don't think there's a no go here. But that's, we'll see. Yeah. Yes.
I'm confused by your talking about a redshift that's caused for the, you know, the effect of shadow. And you have a static geometry.
Yes.
So any ray that actually propagates through that in some fairly large radius.
You're talking about this.
Will not have any redshift.
You're talking about this picture.
Uh-huh. So you say due to very deep redshift, but.
Yeah, that refers to an emission coming from the surface.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Yeah,
if something came all the way in and went all the way out.
But
then,
still,
yeah.
In terms of energy, I mean, stuff coming in deposits a very large amount of energy on the surface because there's a blue shift.
Yes, or that's absorbed into the body. Yeah.
So then the question is, what happens to that energy? And of course, you know, I agree with what everyone's saying about the if you have this divergence, then, and a lot of the photons are, don't escape,
right,
then of course that will cut down the, what you see from behind,
right,
the.
But the challenge for us, which I accept, is to make a physics-based model which can actually accommodate, can absorb this material. And you know, I want to emphasize that, you know, I didn't make up the scale. The scale, you know, didn't come because I wanted to escape your observation. It came because I think that's the size, you know, that you actually expect from quantum effects. Maybe Bob Holden wants to comment because I think he's different.
True. Let's just take the obvious and very facile analogy of a soap bubble.
Yeah.
Right. A soap bubble has an entropy that depends upon the area of the bubble, because that's related to the volume of the stuff and the number of particles and all of that, right? But it's certainly not the area divided by the Planck length squared, right?
That's not the physics of a soap bubble. The atomic physics parameters of the molecules in the surface.
Exactly. So this is all a long way of saying that your argument would be that this scale is the minimum scale at which something must have happened. But depending on the physics of this process of incorporating and creating material.
No, but this didn't come from incorporating material. This came from this semi-classical analysis of vacuum polarization effect.
I'm saying this is the minimum that comes from that, right?
Yeah. Oh, you mean there could be something else?
Right?
Yeah, something else. Okay, sure. Yeah. So
actually, on that, Bob, are you
Bob Holden?
So what was the scale in coordinate, the scale that you found in coordinate units?
Some very small number.
You had this parameter eta, which I don't have.
I think you said 10 to the 12 times the Planck length.
That's proper.
So, but in the coordinate, then there was
10 to the minus 20 something times the coordinate Planck length.
10 to the minus 20. Oh, wow. Okay. So I guess your model is a good laugh. Sorry.
So this square root just comes from this estimate.
So this is much bigger than coordinate Planck.
This physical scale is this is coordinate Planck, but this is the physical.
You're saying it's 10 to the minus 20 coordinate Planck.
Yeah, that's very different.
Okay.
Very different.
So it's very testable. It's already proved that.
Well, we have to get to the point where we stop arguing and you know, can actually make tests, and I'm trying to do that.
So
I think it's open for discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's.
I mean, I think others have
did
to.
You, did any of the speakers
yeah, yeah.
want to say something?
I just wanted to hear more. So at one point toward the end of Bob's talk, Martin made a comment that I didn't catch fully, that whenever you did your analysis that you saw some analogous line. Did you say something like that? He was seeing these peaks in every signal, and you said something about a power line or something like that.
There are peaks, you know, that are persistent. Showed up all the events we looked at, the noise coming, you know, 60 hertz and 1 eV. So you get all 300 to show up consistently throughout. So
there's a lot of non-Gaussian noise, especially in the earlier events.
Yeah,
and you can see it get better and better with the later events.
So I think what LIGO has done is they've actually, they didn't subtract any of that from the early events, and then they started subtracting them as they used other channels of data to identify these, and they actually subtracted this noise. But I think that the key point is that you're trying to find a periodic signal in data which is highly contaminated by many periodic signals. And
so I'm just saying, if there's only one event, then that's a big concern. But if
yeah.
there are 10 events all in different places, then it's not so much of a concern. Because you mentioned 60 hertz or something. Well, that's just one.
No, but these periodic signals are characteristic of the detectors.
I know. But how can it explain 10 different periodic signals that I'm seeing?
So basically, so Bob is saying that he normalizes his results by, I guess, mass of the black holes times some function of the spin, and they all turn out to be the same.
And
if it was just a fixed frequency independent of the black hole, then it shouldn't have been.
So I guess my main, interest would be in seeing this, pretty exhaustive analysis of other data, other noise records, to ensure that you can't find these periodic signals in records that ostensibly don't have any black hole events.
We don't have to argue much longer because the data is already sitting there, already collected,
yep.
And no one's looking at it, at least in the way I'm looking at it, so we have to wait.
And Bob, have you analyzed just LIGO data without any signal in it? And
oh yeah.
And there's no, you don't see any peaks
there? In the first analysis I mentioned, we only found, in the first release data, there was only 5 events, and we found signals in 4 events. And we tried to calculate the p-values for each of those 4 events. And for 3 of the events, the p-value was quite a bit less than 1%. So that was calculating all this background. But I think this type of thing is better left for the experts. If I said I had a p-value, I don't think anyone would believe me anyway. So
are they in the LIGO Virgo, are they now doing this analysis?
No, they're not. Right?
So if they're not doing it, then you have to do it. I don't know what
that
is all there.
Yeah, if we keep this secret, maybe they'll release the data sooner than later.
Probably not. We seem to have lost all the LIGO people, all the cosmologists.
Yeah. No, that's what happens. So,
yeah.
They all disappear.
So Avery, you're to be commended for sticking this out.
So maybe I can go back to actually Gerard's talk in the morning.
Sure. Should I take this
so
on?
I think he had this very compelling picture of, I guess, antipodal identification of a black hole. And I'm wondering whether if you've tried to make a time-dependent picture that, because you, of course, black hole itself, you form it at some point as a star that collapses. And you did show that plot. So can you show where antipodal identification happens in the, collapsing black hole picture or not?
Well, that is a very difficult question. But the idea is, as soon as you have a microscopic black hole, you can make a coordinate transformation. That is just a mathematical procedure. It doesn't change any of the physics. But suppose that you know that at a certain point, the horizon opens up.
Mm.
Then you say, around that point, I'm going to use these new coordinates. Then from that moment on, I can start counting states. Now, when the thing is still very small, normal state is still very small. The approximation is bad. So the approximation becomes better as soon as a black hole gets quite a bit larger than the Planck size. Then the procedure makes sense and you can say, well, I'm making a black hole, a Planck mass over black hole mass ratio expansion, so that.
But you see, the problem I'm having a conceptual problem here because you have your time goes backwards on one side, but before you form a black hole, time only runs in one direction everywhere.
Right.
And then it seems to me that there would, at some point, these two times would run into each other in the causal diagram.
That is property of the transformation.
Yeah.
So
if you can draw something, I would make clarify. I think
yeah.
Of course it could be very qualitative.
You can bring it back if you want.
Do
you want it back? Yeah.
Do you want to connect? I just want to use the black
one.
Yeah, I'll produce the picture.
So this is a picture for the eternal black hole. Now, I can also say that's a picture of where most of the galaxy material has been removed by transformation. You just say it may change in the past, not in the present, that change state from which black hole evolved, but doesn't change the procedure of counting all the black hole states. Most of the black hole states are in the past, but it's not evolved. By a recent collapse. So that claim is removing the influence particles, removing the line here, doesn't change much of what happens in the future. It does change, if you extrapolate the past, it does change the past. So this matter causes gravitational curvature. That curvature changes the past into some other Well, in fact, the flats, locally flat space times then, assumes that all the enclosures have together, this becomes flat. And this becomes, because you flat, just all the enclosure space here. And actually, you don't have this even either, because only this region one, like all this region three. So only these regions survive this, but region two and region four are now disappear and change flat.
So that's a standard GR, right?
That is a standard, yeah.
Okay.
And now I say that itself, describing all these particles within one particle, I look at the shift they cause in outgoing particles, and now I say, okay, the outgoing particles, they are sitting on this quotient surface, and now they get shifted. So I remove the inward particle, replace it by shifting outgoing particles. Those outgoing particles are softer, so they have to make energy here. From that moment on, this I turn to the internal diagram that.
So where does the transition happen? Because standard GR, time goes up everywhere, but
yes.
Then at some point in your picture, time goes backwards, right?
Yeah.
So there must be some transition somewhere, like you go, time goes forward to backwards, right?
I think you know how you see Kuzma's figures go forward, it's low, the time orbital structure
right.
goes up here, it goes down here. So now, this is a major departure from ordinary wisdom to say that this describes the same universe as this, but just only you have to go degrees around the line to find this universe. But here, some the time goes down and shift. What I didn't show, I thought time was on top. I actually draw a minus from here to getting out of that hole and then re-emerging at this side, and the minus then closes. But we have a strip where now the time orbit trips over and you join the two ends through the horizon. So that is a topological, non-trivial feature of space-time that emerges out of this procedure. So the picture I have now that is that when you have a black hole formating out of some black process, but here the horizon opens up, this is flat space, practically. So here the horizon opens up. I take this small thing, and I say, at this small thing, I have to replace flat space time by ordinary orbits, which makes it look like this. So then what you're doing is you're cutting out a piece of space time, turn it over, include back.
And what happens to the star, like material inside the star? You just cut them out and forget about them? Or?
Yeah, so the idea is something happens to the Planck scale. That is a difficult part of the theory. I don't understand exactly what happens at the Planck scale, so I think people find that an excuse acceptable. so at the very close to the Planck scale, we have this thing which I also have on my screens. That is to say, you wipe out this part of space time and you glue the endpoints together. But not only the space direction, also the time direction, you're doing together. So then you go through this empty space, you jump from here to here, you also into time, into space.
But when is the Planck scale? I mean, when you form the event horizon, I mean, the densities are finite. I mean, densities are not very big. That's the first moment when the event horizon formed. But then the event horizon gets bigger. So I'm not sure when you said Planck scale, you mean the horizon size is Planck scale, or is it the densities are Planck?
This point. So imagine that there's something in quantum physics that you don't understand, which causes that space-time is full of such bubbles. That's small from vacuum fluctuations. This you call a vacuum fluctuation. It's like an instant bubble, literally, because it is bubbles in four dimensions of space-time. So now we have all these bubbles there, and when you have this hard black hole formation up here, then the bubble that was sitting here is now expanding. And now we say, okay, now I'm going to consider this is a blown up picture of that bubble. Then then describe the ingoing particles going in here, when more go in, other particles go out, outgoing particles go like that. But if there are fewer outgoing particles and ingoing particles, then the thing doesn't grow. So from that moment on, it's this description where I understand the details. It's a very initial step, which admittedly is very difficult. And I think it involves quantum physics of time, you can't describe the potential population, it's a concept, so which I don't quite understand. So okay, if you say that part of the theory is still wrong or immature, okay, fine. But say as soon as
no, I just want to understand that that's okay.
It is, as soon as this picture applies, I can start doing my playing.
So the answer is the black hole always exists. It's like a bubble nucleation problem.
Well,
it always
of course
exists.
You suspect that there will be vector fluctuations all around us. There are microscopic planetary black holes all around us. That's not such a crazy subject. Today it doesn't mean that because we don't know what to do with it anyway. So we don't know how to control it in the bubble. So I'm saying this
is not being published. Can I ask a different question? I know you want to maybe cut the discussion at some point, but do I understand in your picture that the ingoing and outgoing quanta are strongly interacting near the horizon and getting very entangled?
Yeah, so the slow interaction looks like this big wall effect.
Yeah.
So you have this angle, and now you say, okay, the ingoing part is going in here, outgoing are going up here. Now, they come out much, much later than the inward part. The ones that are caused by this are coming out much later. So if you have an inward part, the outward part is very close to the horizon. If you have an inward particle that went in long ago, the outward particle will come up here. So now you can draw this line as the line where r equals 2gn plus a small delta r, which is this distance away from the
right,
so that's when you have a brick wall. So this is a brick wall. You see everything, everybody's bouncing against the brick wall.
But then aren't the particle interactions playing an important
these
role?
Bounces are a way of describing the particle interaction. The actual interaction is not the brick wall, it might be a general law, which there's no brick, here. Accumulate on the future horizon.
Should I think of these interactions as gravitational, or
yes,
what about standard model interactions at high energies?
Yeah, but the gravitational ones blow up with the energy squared. The whole standard model interactions stay constant, or logarithmic. But so the inward particles follow a wave function on by. Asking where the interaction will be. Future mental eyes, you describe it as a wave function. You take the Fourier transform wave function, that sits on this line. And you understand this wave function contracts the Fourier transform expands. So you see how this axis can have this axis by Fourier transform. And this now looks rather messy like this picture. when you go to spherical harmonics, you go to the LM state. You find that at every L and M, there's just one of these wave functions. And for both in and out. And then the energy, E, referring to the outside time coordinate T, that energy is strictly conserved. So one nice thing about this feature is that you say, okay, the particles which are, we went in long ago, because the future particles will be spread out, then I can remove this incoming particle, and say that it is part now of my black hole. So the mass of the whole system, the mass of the universe, of each, or the energy of that domain of the universe, consists of the particles in that, and in, that are far away, plus the M out, that are far away. So far away, there are particles moving out and moving in. They do not belong to the black hole. And the rest are called black hole. So, clearly, depending on which particle you think is far enough away to not become as a member of the black hole anymore, then you say, okay, that belongs here, the remainder is the black hole mass. But by just doing your administration, now you see the black hole mass this time in bandwidth, because anywhere particles move in, they come closer and closer to the horizon. As soon as they're sufficiently close, they start to contribute to the mass of the black hole infinitesimally. So I have to collect billions of particles to make the black hole grow, the black hole shrink. In a large black hole approximation, that's the picture. So you need very, very many in and outgoing particles. We all, I only consider very light particles going in, very light particles going out. If I have heavy particles going in, that's going to be another story. That's much more difficult to
do these particle interactions interfere with the standard Hawking pictures based on free fields? I mean, is this just accounted for by some Bogoliubov transformation, or?
I stay away from the horizon. I can make free field approximations. Of course, the particles interact as usual in standard mode, small particle parameters, but the standard mode only makes sense as long as the coupling stays sufficiently weak. So these are approximately free particles. And then in one picture, you don't see any of the argument patterns there, in another picture, you don't see any of them there. In the complete picture, you don't see, the lone observer will have his own ideas of patterns. So, what the argument about transforming this into the state seen by this observer is totally valid. So, if this observer who sits locally at the center sees nothing, the outside observer sees Hawking patterns getting out, but also Hawking patterns coming in. So the state is just nothing here, has both in and out particles here. So that's what you need to transform from local physics here to global physics far away in this observer. You have to make this transformation, which is just the Hartle-Hawking transformation, which is Bogoliubov transformation.
At the level of free fields.
Creation and annihilation operators at, you know, very well, the vacuum state is the same as all the annihilation operators vanish.
But this you do at the level of free fields without worrying about strong interactions.
That's right. So this is all free field theory now. Mm-hmm. And then you say, okay, I only have sufficient heat to let the particles is a vanished approximation. So now, and I say, okay, Hawking, Hartle-Hawking vacuum has all the annihilators vanished. But annihilators seem to and this observer are not the same annihilators as seen by this observer, and that's where Hawking combination comes from. The vacuum becomes something else. If this A is a reducible position of A and A better than the outside. And that's what happens. That's how we can how we get all these results. But you need, in this case, you need a pure state running all the way from here to here. So this is now a closure surface, and I have particles in here and in here, and now I can use, now this is the Hartle-Hawking state wave function. So the Hartle-Hawking wave function is the scattered of particles in region 1 and the particles in region 2. If I leave any one of them out, I can't do the Fourier transform anymore. And Hawking says, I have to sum up all states here to get what the actual observer sees, because he only sees one hemisphere. It happens to be still true, because the black hole, you only look at one hemisphere, and you look at the black hole. So in that hemisphere, you don't see the hemisphere on the other side. So if you don't measure that, what you're supposed to see here, you're not going to trouble. Because you're averaging all of these states, that's what we did anyway. But he thought this was the inside of the black hole. Now I say, no, it's not the inside, it's the other side of the black hole. In other cases, when you look at the particle from now, you don't see the other side anyway. So even that, even my picture, the Hawking's result is still exactly right. For that reason.
So are there other, I guess, comments by, like, about other speakers' talks, or just by anyone else in the room? You have a big room full of people. Everybody's silent. I can ask one more question. So do you have any prediction for some observable?
Well, I thought this was only possible because only for Planck size black holes, never to have any effect on large black holes. But I think I'm getting something that is very much like what Ball was talking about.
Echoes?
Nearly these echo things. Because I can also ask what happens if I set in the heavy object. And I'm not sure how accurate this description still will be. But I made a semi-classical approximation saying, okay, suppose a particle goes in with energy much more than the typical Hawking energy. Then what happens? And then I mean, WKP approximation, the particle goes in like this, what's its Fourier transform? And then something very strange comes up. That is that I draw this brick wall here, but now I get in my black hole, I get a brick wall here. And I don't know why that's so, but you can understand. If you now send the particle in here, the particle goes through the horizon, then it gets out in at the other approach. So now, if this thing it falls back into them, then this becomes a closed circle. And that those are those hanging things, I think, that we see. So maybe there is a prediction that that whatever falls into your black hole will give a signal at the other side of at the other hemisphere. And maybe this will hang around periodically and do something similar that might conceivably be observable. So there may be observable consequences, but for that I don't get to see a lot of control.
That's pretty exciting. I had one other question. So you described how you.
Layton, you talk too much.
Yeah.
Lina hasn't said anything.
Oh, okay. maybe you have mentioned that in your talk, but so are you claiming that this solves the baryon number conservation by black hole? So you're saying that the same number of baryons get emitted by the black hole are
okay. The theory requires that you describe the particles only in terms of their momentum distribution and their positions, not their other quantum numbers.
Okay,
so the theory doesn't attach quantum numbers at all to the other particles. At the same time, the theory also ignored all the Stamp-Moore interactions. So if you put all that back in, you ask the question again, and that's very hard, but that's connecting the model for all the Stamp-Moore interactions. Now, you know, any U1 symmetry that exists in this world has a gauge field attached to it. So if you don't really want, you have to judge as it has a form of attached to it. There are other U1 theories, U1 symmetries, which have no formula connected with such a very number, but then it's not exactly conserved. Instead of all Baryon numbers violated. If there would be exact Baryon number conservation in the sample, which could have been the case, if it just happens not to be so, but there could be variations on the sample where there would be an exactly conserved U1 global symmetry. Then I would say my theory predicts that seems to be wrong.
B minus seven, that's it.
Yes, B minus seven, indeed. There's a few things that are anomalous actually. You're right. That's a symmetry that should also be considered. And so it predicts that B minus L, B plus L, all the other symmetries are also, they must all be wrong. That's the only consistent answer I can give. But what this does tell me also is that not every standard model is allowed. Because I can imagine a standard model that we might have to conserve. That's fine. Today's standard model still has that. So that apparently there are constraints that theories like this will put on the standard model. That's the most important prediction. That if someone manages to make this theory as stretch it as far as possible, maybe the other part is constraints of what kind of standard model you know. And part of the physicists will not see that. Say, you know, for instance, supersymmetry could well be a requirement. I haven't seen supersymmetry come over by itself, but supersymmetry adherents would say, well, we're going to repeat the story in the supersymmetric scenario. And maybe they'll say, well, supersymmetry will be predicted, like this in string theory, for instance. This theory has many things in common. It's not the same.
You can go ahead there.
So you were imposing this antiphonal identification to make the scattering unitary. I was just wondering if you have any speculations about where it comes from, or what causes it at a fundamental level, or is it that?
It comes from about the possibility of having topological discs in space-time, particularly at the Planck scale. So the suspicions are at the Planck scale that those also in some domain structures that actually are topological to the interval. The big things are when you take space, four dimensions of space-time, you carve out S three sphere and its interior, and you empty that, and then you glue that topology together. That's topologically non-trivial, because what happens is that if you go through such an instrument, you see time minus time and all that, and you get also guaranteed dust conditions and charge condition. So the idea is that all PCT is still the same if you go through, but PCT is separately, PCT is broken. So
and any thoughts about why that is for, so somehow every black hole has to have that twist?
Well, I think it's about the space and time itself. Before you make that hole. And space and time has these a lot like simple calculations. So the idea is that now we have to reconsider how to quantize gravity, taking these topological features of space-time into account.
Maybe I can also remark from a different point of view, but I think it's resonating with this, but I'm often asked, well, what happened to the baryon number inside of this condensate? And I believe it has to be violated. We know in the standard.
I think also believe that black holes must violate all entropy conserved properties.
Right. So
it's not limited to solids.
So
just multiply.
So in a violent production of this object, I have high enough energies that should somehow wipe out the baryon number and all the global charges.
Well, we already know if Hawking is high at all, black holes in this black holes, they can't actually have baryon number conserved or any other.
So the problem is already there.
So you don't need to see everything.